Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2024, both adult and CYA categories, and other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $150,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial festivals and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial-free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. Catherine MacKinnon's 2017 novel, Storyland, was shortlisted for 5 literary awards, including, in 2018, the Miles Franklin Literary Award, the Barbara Jeffries Award, and the Voss Literary Prize. Her second novel, The Complex and Textured To Sing of War, was longlisted for the 2024 ARA Historical Novel Prize, Adult Category. Welcome, Catherine MacKinnon, to Imagining the Past.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
I always start with when did you start writing and how did that kind of come about?
Oh, I started very young in school, in writing poetry. And I can remember we had a fabulous English teacher who would get us writing about our lives. And so the very first writing I remember is, being quite young, writing on the beach and taking it, my little scraps into class. That was when I began. And then later in life, I worked as I did a degree in English Lit and Drama. And I did a kind of drama course. And so I worked for a while as a theatre writer and director, as well as just writing prose in general. And then I wrote my first book, which was called The Nearly Happy Family. That was my very first book. And then my second was Storyland, a much longer book.
Right. What year did that first one come out?
2008 it came out. I had won a short story competition and it was connected to Penguin, and they said, have you got anything else? And I think that I did the Nearly Happy Family as part of, I was going to UTS and did it as part of I think it was a master's degree, in creative writing, and had a lovely woman, Glenda Adams, who was our teacher there, an Australian writer who's since sadly died. I had a short story that was picked up in a competition and they said, have you got anything else? And I said, well, yes, I do. I have a book. And so they published it. And then I did a PhD for my second novel, a creative writing PhD, and I wrote story because I had a big idea. Storyland was set from the past to the future and it was dealing with, climate change to the land. It's set along a river in the Illawarra. And it crosses time, 5 different stories. And so I wanted some support while I was writing that big project. And so I was living in the Illawarra, but I got a scholarship at Flinders University to do the PhD, a creative PhD And so I wrote that novel as a PhD, and that was picked up by HarperCollins. And then, yeah, after that, I wrote To Sing of War.
So what was the first idea you kind of had for To Sing of War? Like, where did you start work on it?
Actually, I started work, I started it as a long short story when Storyland was being considered by HarperCollins, because they were taking a while to take it to acquisitions. And so I thought, okay, start on something else. I always start on something else before I finish anyway. And so, you know, Storyland was, you know, was all about changing weather and what had been happening. And I was in a kind of group that met to talk about that sort of thing. And we wrote another book called a collective called 100 Atmospheres, which is a kind of mixed kind of lots of small, 100 little small pieces, basically, intermingled with essays. And so I kind of got interested in the first atomic bomb testing, you know, the first testing, which was at a place in Alamogordo called Trinity. And this was in the Second World War. And I started reading about that and thinking it could be interesting to write a story about the thinking behind that testing, because that set off so many changes in the world and in our climate. And so I was just working on that. And then just coincidentally, at the same time, my father got very sick and we all flew home. And he rallied and recovered. And in the weeks after, he lived in Adelaide. I would ring him each week and we'd talk. And he had never really talked about his war experiences. And so on one of these nights when we kind of got a bit stuck because we were talking about death, you know, he said, "What are you working on?" And I told him. And then he told me the first ever war story he had ever told, which was about being stuck high up in the Torricelling Mountains in New Guinea. The first time he'd heard the word atomic bomb, he was up in the Torricelling Mountains in New Guinea. They were dug in. The Japanese were across a ravine. No one was firing because no one had any ammunition. It was in the, you know, in early August. And they had had two supposed drops of ammunition, which had been a drop of tea and a drop of cigarettes. So they had no food. So they had very little food and they were just high on tea and cigarettes. And back they heard this crackle and it went from the radio and it ran around, you know, atomic bomb has been dropped. And they had no, they'd never heard the words before, and they thought it had been initially it was New Guinea. And then eventually through the night, you know, more and more information came out. It was the atomic bomb in Japan, the first one in Hiroshima. And so that was, they knew then it was going to be the end of the war, but they had to wait some time before it was the end of the war. And gradually, I suppose, as I was working on those two things, they came together. So the novel To Sing of War is set in Los Alamos in a group of people. It traces three characters, a young scientist called Mim Carver, a physicist who's working with Robert Oppenheimer they're working on the plutonium bomb and trying to get that ready. And there's also a perspective from Kitty Oppenheimer. And then it also covers New Guinea and the story of a young soldier going through the last stages of the war, the last 9 months, arriving in New Guinea and moving through the Torricelling Mountains to the Prince Alexandra Mountains. And that basically follows the trail that my father did, you know, his platoon and what they did do. And then also a small section weaves through Japan and a family living on the Isle of Miyajima.
Yeah, the novel is very complex. As you said, there's kind of three major settings and there's six different points of view. So I'm always interested in how one novel seeds another novel. So did this novel kind of grow out of Storyland? You've kind of mentioned Storyland was complex. So did you build on the ground that you kind of had established and the kind of, not methods, not the right word, but the way it unfolded in Storyland, did you kind of build on that with this?
I did, really. I think, yeah, you're right. It's interesting. I sort of thought about multiple perspectives in Storyland a lot, you know, and try, you know, how it can work. A long time ago, not that long, but I suppose there was a novel called Cloud Atlas. I don't know if you've ever read it, by David Mitchell. And I loved that novel. I just thought it was so fantastic. And even before that, when I was quite young, I was very taken with Orlando, that jump time and space. Yeah. You know, I sort
also,
of, and even.
Also, sorry, interrupting you. I remember reading Patrick White's The Twyborn Affair.
Yes.
Which was
yes.
just kind of a ride, really. Like, it, I mean, it,
yeah.
I remember when I read it thinking it must be the queerest book ever written in Australia, really.
Yeah. And also, when you think about it, when you just go back to stories of childhood, Narnia, and, you know, jumping through, they're actually linked, jumping through time, going into different lands. I think in a way they're all, there's links between all those kinds of jumping time, jumping geographical location. So, yes, I sort of was, in this one, I thought, oh, I won't jump from time to time, but maybe I can work this story that looks at the interconnections from location to location, especially since Australia is so influenced, or has been since that Second World War in particular, by America and what happens in America. So it was sort of interesting to look at the beginnings of that and to weave in what was happening and look not only what was falling apart, but what kind of connections were happening as well. So, yeah.
So you've touched on this a little bit, but I mean, I would imagine that having so many characters, so many points of view, and the different scenarios, there would be some challenges in getting that to work, because often I think in experienced hands to do this, you just end up with so much exposition, because every time you go back to a point of view, it has to be cemented in again and kind of contextualized again. So what were some of the challenges of getting all of this to work? Because it is incredibly complex, I think.
I think you need to really work hard on introducing characters in a simple way and getting an understanding of each of the world and the environments quite quickly. But, you know, I try to do that through action, you know. So it's trying to marry, you know, introducing people through the action of the main protagonist of that section, you know. So if it's a Virgil section, who are all his mates? How does it work? How does that world work? But he carries it along through his voice. It's a lot of work to try and craft, really, the way that you can do that in a way that falls easily on the reader's ear, and so that the stories feel like, I work really hard on trying to make the stories feel like yarns, or, you know, like a good story, which is marrying, I suppose, summary and scene, you know, with together. So that you can get a lot of information quickly, but you get really detailed scenes that take you and immerse you in the world.
Also, surely using plot, you know, which is often a derided concept. But
oh yeah, you know, no, I think, well, that's what I mean. Story. I love a good plot.
Yeah, the thread really that sews it all together. You've written, and I think Storyland was as well, in present tense. Always kind of interested in what attracts people to do that.
Sometimes I like both, you know, present and past tense. But present tense, I think, is a really good way of working on the past, because it can make it feel immediate for the reader. So it's you know, no one, when you're writing fiction, in a way, no one's ever completely, we read from our present. It's a little bit like all those, I'm thinking of all the Tudor novels, and you know, the ones that work well make it feel like you can smell it and be there now, even if the language, you have to work on the language actually to make sure that you get the language. You know, you can't go back exactly to the language. You've got to find something that works, that carries a sense of the language. And so in this one, the present tense works, I hope, to make people feel very close to the characters and feel enmeshed in their world. So that, I think that's what drew me to it. But, you know, you go back and forth as you're experimenting, trying to work out what works best. And I think in the end you settle on something that seems to work well for you. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I just find sometimes people don't fully understand what writing in present tense is, and it often becomes quite, the texture of the language becomes quite monochromatic, particularly if it's in third person, you end up with, you know, is and a gerund often. Mm. And you also, I mean, I think one of the, well, when you learn another language, the bugbear is irregular verbs, which just drive a new person mad. But in English, for me, irregular verbs are where the language really comes alive. And all of that's kind of lost by using present tense. And I think people kind of forget that if they're going to lose all those things, then they have to work very hard to do other things.
I think one of the things that whenever I'm doing sort of deep, dark stuff, you know, which happened in, there's a section of Storyland which is a particularly dark story, and obviously a war story has a lot of dark story. I often read Shakespeare because that was part of my background. And the way of talking about dark material as if the characters are there and present now, there is a way that you can do it through imagery, through the way that people talk and use imagery within their sentence structure. And so, yeah, I work on that a lot.
Mm. I think that's clear. I mean, as I've said, I think a lot of things I've read that are in present tense have, the language has just become very monochromatic, or the grammar has become quite monochromatic.
Yeah.
So the weight of, there's 6 points of view, as we've discussed. 4 of them are female and 2 are male. What kind of decisions did you make around selecting the characters, and were you kind of conscious of a gender bias towards females in the points of view?
I definitely wanted to, in the Los Alamos story, because so much had been done about that the women had been forgotten. So I definitely wanted to bring to light that there were women scientists working there, you know, a lot of them younger, but doing a lot of hard work. And so I always wanted to have a young female scientist. And I read a lot and researched a lot about young female scientists, and Mim is based on a couple of young women who worked at Los Alamos. And they were part of the, you know, the frontline team, if you like, but they were just younger, that's all. They weren't the Oppenheimers or the Becker or, you know, the Hans Bethe, you know, they weren't, you know, the Feynmans, they weren't those, but they were working with them, you know, Kistakovsky. You know, they're all so interesting, all of those, the people working there. So they were great. They were great characters to work on. It was a great, in terms of interest and what people were doing. And it was like this, they were all caught in this military compound, really. But from all across the globe, you know, really these people trying to solve a problem, which many of them thought was for, up until Hitler died, for a good cause, to perhaps develop an atomic bomb, because they thought Hitler was potentially developing an atomic bomb. And then there were changes as soon as they knew that that wasn't the cause, that Hitler did not have an atomic program, and it was going to be dropped on Japan. Then there was a lot of changes within the scientists about whether they should go on or not. And so that was part of what the story was focusing on in Los Alamos. In And then I think in Japan, because I had a kind of link with a soldier, a Japanese soldier, that it's a family in Japan. There's a soldier in New Guinea called Kenzo, and I focus on his wife in Japan, and the story of them running a little inn. And also I wanted to connect it to a story in Japan about there's been an eternal flame running there for 1,200 years. It's a site of peace, and it's on this mountain that has never been, you know, a tree has never been chopped down, an animal has never been killed because of the belief systems around it. And I just wanted this sort of island of peace in the center of this great war, kind of as a reminder that people are always trying to work towards peace. And so Hiroko and her husband's grandmother, they walk up every day and deliver rations to the two monks that live up there and keep the flame going. So in a sense, that was more a decision based on, you know, a link with her husband as a soldier in Japan, and he's captured, and, you know, a kind of the way they were living their lives and trying to live a life that kept peace alive in a very small way. Yeah, and then, you know, it was just in New Guinea, I sort of was following the story of my father's platoon, but making up the characters from that. So, the life of nurses in Itapi, you know, the in that final campaign, Itapi to Wewak, it was, and just mingling that together. So it sort of, they grew, I suppose. You know, you a bit like in Storyland. Originally, I had 9 stories in Storyland, which I brought down to 6, because that 6 is about the amount the reader can hold in their head. You know, it's sort of, there's been a lot of research done on, especially now that we have so many TV series, and, you know, it's about 6 stories that comfortably readers can hold in their head that you can intertwine. And so I just was aware of that. And, you know, you just keep, you get interested and you go down, follow a character, but then you narrow it down gradually. So a mixture of 2. I was aware, yes, that I wanted to bring women, especially into Los Alamos. And I wanted to put definitely in this story of violence, so the women in Los Alamos, because they'd not been talked about, but in this story of violence, I wanted to think about, you know, the violence of war, but also, we have always, rape is a very big thing in our life now, and it's a huge thing in war. And I wanted to pitch it at kind of that different kind of violence against this national violence, and think about those two things together. I did want to bring that into people's thinking, definitely.
Mm. So you've touched on some of these points, but it's clearly that the novel has a massive amount of research. So how long did all of that take, and what kind of tricks did you use to kind of unearth things, and did you have any big standout finds during that?
If I'd known, you sort of stumble into them and then you go, oh, my God, this is so much work. I had thought, after Storyland, I thought that is a huge amount of work, which I did as part of a PhD. So, you know, I had the time and the space, but it took about, you know, it took the 4 and a bit years of the PhD and then longer to rewrite it and get it, the novel ready. And so it was 8 years by the time it was published, Storyland. So I wanted it to be shorter. And I thought, I'm going to stay in the same time zone. But once you start researching, you realize how much you need to know about each area. And it's huge. So, I work from place, so I feel like I'm a place writer. I need to be in place to write. So I went to New Guinea and was there for 2 months, and, you know, went along parts of the trail. It's not a tourist trail like the Kokoda Track, so it was much more difficult. But went along parts and lived there and wrote there, and did that a little bit in Japan, because I was never sure whether I was going to include Japan or not. I had to do all the research, but I was never, I just was never sure about whether I would write a Japanese section or not. Then also went for a couple of months to America, to Los Alamos and Alamogordo, and then followed, you know, visited Washington and Berkeley and all the places where Oppenheimer had lived and worked, just to New York, just to get a sense of the different places for that character. And there were fines. I'm just sort of wondering. I mean, one of the big things is history is never what you think it's going to be. You know, I did a lot of archival research as well. So just going through all the, say, the nurses research in ITP and what happened at the, you know, 2nd of the 11th General Hospital. The speed which they set a whole hospital up, 3 weeks it took them to set that hospital up. And they had, you know, they had physiotherapists, they had surgery, they had all sorts of areas. And then they had these, you know, funny rules like, you know, nude bathing days, which you just go, really? In 1945, they had, you know, hours that they had nude bathing for women and men, which just really shocked me. But the more that I sort of unearthed it, part of that nude bathing regulation was health. You know, they wanted people to get sun on their bodies to help combat, you know, if you've ever been to those countries, if you get a sore and you scratch it, it gets bigger and bigger. So the sun was one of the ways of healing. And they wanted to allow people time to, you know, get their bodies in the sun, and also the patients. So yeah, that was really fun and so interesting.
Did you at what point did you actually at what point of the research did you actually start writing? So did you, you know, start and then drag in more research, or are you the type of writer who just wants all the research done before you actually start writing?
No, I think I start writing often quite early. I do bits of research, bits of writing. Sometimes the writing helps me then understand what research I need to do.
Need to find, yeah.
Yeah. So I sort of, you know, I'm a sort of believer, you know, Charlotte Wood talks about this thing, following the heat, you know, and I sort of believe in that. You know, you've got to follow your interest and follow your nose a little bit and ferret things out. And then you've got to sit back and go, okay, what can work in this story? What can't? What's really maybe too much research? And often the first draft is too big. You know, it's way too big and full of too much stuff, and you have to whittle it back down. So yeah.
The New Guinea section is very detailed. It sounds like a lot of that came out of your father's stories. So it kind of felt like the New Guinea section had formed something of a template that you then had to bring the other sections up to with the research. Is that kind of fair? It felt like you had done so much in that New Guinea section that the rest of it had to come up to that as well.
I'd started with actually Mim and Oppenheimer. And so I started with those rather than, so the New Guinea came later. So I started with the Los Alamos sections, but didn't get them complete. And then I did go to New Guinea first, in terms of place, and spent a lot of time writing those sections. So, I think they intermingled.
All right. So it is a complete kind of parquetry floor.
Yeah, I like that. I think a parquetry floor is what it's like. It's like a parquetry floor.
Yeah, I mean,
and then you're going, should I put this bit of wood here, or should I put this other bit of wood here?
And it all has to feed in on itself, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
So naming the
it has to work. I mean, it has to work as a story. If it doesn't work as a story, you know, you're not engaging the reader that's sort of primary. So the research, although we're talking about a lot of research, I really feel like once you've done the research, you have to let the research go and just really help the story develop, you know, and hopefully intrigue the reader.
Yeah. The naming of a character, Virgil, I mean, Virgil's a pretty loaded name. How did you come about that? What was some of your thinking around that?
I mean, I've always loved the name Virgil, and, you know, Virgil is, It's interesting, you know, in different locations around the world, Virgil's not such a, like in Indian, American Indian populations, there's often children called Byron, Virgil. you know, interestingly, funny, you know, poets' names. I'm not sure why that is. But I was interested in bringing in the novel's called To Sing of War, and it starts with a song, you know, with the soldiers, Australian soldiers singing a song. And I was interested in the Aeneid and all those early myths that we learn at school, and that sometimes seem far away. They originated somewhere in an experience, you know, in a real world experience. And so that way that story moves into myth and legend, but some comes from some kind of truth somewhere. And so I just wanted that to be part of the weaving of what war is, that, you know, we celebrate this thing called war, but it comes from real great tragedy. And, you know, I just wanted to contrast that and bring that in. And also, I just think, you know, we had this book called The Aeneid kicking around our house when I was growing up, and everyone's name would go in it. You know, I come from a family of eight. And, you know, and I actually used that. I still have that, you know, that little plastic-covered book with all the family names in it as it went through each family member. And so it was kind of, the book was kind of also part of a family story. And my grandfather was a teacher in the country, and he was Scottish, and he loved to be he was a bit of a country, loved to tell a tale of old, you know, as his party trick, you know. So it sort of came from all those different sources.
Yeah, I think it's a nice idea to, as you said, when at school, when you first read the Aeneid or hear about these stories, they do just seem so distant and so far away, but they're so alive. We're still acting out essentially the same things now.
Yeah, absolutely.
As we've talked about today, the writing process is quite long. I just kind of not sure how to ask you this, but in dealing with an historical event, there's always the risk that someone else will arrive at your story before you do. So I'm just wondering, were you aware of the production of Oppenheimer, the film, and before it was released, and it must have been being produced while you were producing your novel? So I'm just kind of wondering what kind of effect that had on your novel or your writing.
I wasn't aware till just before it came out, but, you know, 6 months before it came out. And I was working on it way before. So, you know, Storyland was published in 2017. I went to New Guinea in 2016 to do the first research for To Sing of War. And I'd written about Oppenheimer before that. So I'd started on it, you know, in those years before Storyland was published, in the couple of years beforehand. And but just in, you know, not working on it full time, because I work full time too. So I was a bit devastated, but the publishers said, no, we think it'll be great, because, you know, it will help people understand the world of Oppenheimer, and your story is quite different in a way, which I think it is. Oppenheimer, the movie Oppenheimer focuses on, you know, a hero of a supposed, perhaps hero or not hero, but a character in America who was raised to great heights and then dumped and then raised a little bit again. That story of what America does to its people. And that's not what To Sing of War is about. I mean, Oppenheimer's in there as an interesting character, but it focuses on the decision to continue to work on the plutonium bomb. He has a great part in which he did in real life in swaying the scientists to keep going with the work till they actually contest the plutonium bomb, which was dropped on Nagasaki. So yeah, that they have different they do have different kind of agendas, I suppose.
And focus, really, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so would if you had found out about the film earlier in your research, or if your research had been later when the film, you know, you had been at an earlier stage of your process when the film came out, do you think it would have stopped you, or do you think you would have been
I up? Don't know. I really don't know. I mean, I was already so embedded in it, so, you know, no. I think... It that's a sort of hard question because I don't know the answer to that, but I do think that people approach particular topics in different ways. I was actually quite interested that that they did come out at the same time, and I think we're about the same age, and I think the interest in nuclear and atomic energy. I grew up in an age where nuclear was a problem, and as a child I can remember worrying the fact that, you know. So I think they, you know, different people arrive at a time in their life where they become interested in those things. So I think that's interesting that a group of people over there were interested in developing the film. But, yeah, I don't think I can really answer that question. I don't know. Sometimes people say when you talk to someone and you're talking about an idea and they say, oh, I've got that idea. I always say, well, you know, it doesn't matter. We've both got a similar idea. That doesn't matter. You'll do it really differently. Yeah. We'll do it really differently.
Yeah, it's hard. I started writing something that was based on Maud Gom and Yeats, and as I'd done a fairly hefty amount of research because, I mean, I don't understand Maud Gom at all. So, and I'd done quite a lot of the research, and then someone came out with a novel on it, and I just kind of thought, I'm out. It was a woman who'd written it as well, and it was really about Maud Gom. So, you know, I kind of thought, I've got no inroad here at all. So I stopped it.
Actually, that has happened to me. I did a reasonable amount of work on Mary Shelley and Frankenstein. I was really interested in maybe writing a story. And I was thinking of doing it as a sliding doors, that weekend when they wrote their ghost stories, you know, Shelley and Byron, the two Shelleys and Byron were around writing their ghost stories and maybe a future. And then, I worked out my idea, and then someone said, I think there's a book out that does that. And I looked around for it, and I found Jeanette Wintinson had, you know, just put out this book. And it was such a similar idea. She was using a future as well, two times. And the future was an AI lecturer. Anyway. And I thought, yeah, those ideas are very similar. The idea I had was different, but it was about AI, and I thought they're just too similar, so I didn't.
So World War II fiction still seems to attract a lot of attention, and even World War I, even though I think publishers and agents have been saying for a while that they're not, it's at its day. What do you think it is about these stories that are set in that time that really does attract readers still?
I think with historical fiction, there's sorts of, you know, we can go back to, you know, there's a big thing about medieval stories at the moment, or, stories set in, I'm just thinking of, I've forgotten the name of it for the moment. The last, Constantinople, or, you know, there's, so that I think that as long as you develop the characters and you make it interesting to a present day reader, then you can, in a way, you can shine a light on something that they may not have thought about before. And so then it'll be interesting. For me, it's in the story. If the story is interesting, it will pull someone in. But I think you're right. Publishers are saying, I mean, at the moment they're saying, romance fantasy is the big thing and crime. But not everyone can write romance fantasy or crime. And also if everyone tried, it wouldn't work. You've got to try and, I think, write what draws you, but write it really well so that people will like the story. And I think, as writers, we shine a light on something and we draw people to it, even if they weren't interested in it beforehand. So it doesn't always work. That's true. It doesn't always work. Sometimes it can be hard. I don't know. Publishing at the moment is a little bit tricky, I'd have to say. It's sort of what they're saying is that readers are being less experimental. They're going with the authors that they know more, and they're not experimenting with new authors as much. That's what some of the publishers are saying.
Yeah, I think we've got this kind of overhang from COVID in a way that we all went through this terrible time, and I think people do just want to read things that are either uplifting or a bit light and fluffy as well at the moment. So what are you working on now?
I'm working on two stories. One is set in a small town, and it's, I don't want it to be a long novel, and it's about a woman and a family and things that go wrong in the town. And someone disappears is part of that sort of setup. And the other one is kind of set in the 70s. And it's a story about young girls who go to a place in Surfers Paradise, and they come into contact with a particular kind of crime, violence, but they don't recognize it as that. It's not obvious to them, and it's sort of about them understanding the adult world, I suppose, that it is crime and these people can't be trusted. They're the two that I'm working on at the moment.
So do you often work on a couple of things at the same time?
I mean, it depends on what takes off. I've done quite a bit on the I've written about 70,000 words on the latter one, set in Surfers, but probably about 30 that are good, and the other one's more just developing the idea, writing little bits and pieces. Sometimes I have a few things going because it just depends what pulls you. So I'd like to get a draft done of the other one and then just let it sit. I quite like things to sit for a while.
Yeah, but
Patrick White used to let things sit. I used to read a lot about Patrick White, and he used to let things sit for 6 months, and then go back to it. And so I'm not frightened of that, of letting something sit coming back.
Yeah, I think that kind of maceration process is quite good to just leave things soaking in their own juices for a while and then come back
to them. Yeah.
So you were long listed for the ARA Historical Novel Prize. I'm just wondering how that was, and what do you think the role of these kinds of prizes are?
They're good. I mean, that's a great prize. And so along with Lauren Shader, I think, and I was long listed, and then we were both highly commended. And it just helps. Yeah, it really does make a difference, in terms of readership, and to your publishers. So it really helps the readership notice the book, and it really helps your publishers feel confident in you as a writer, and that's important because publishers have, there are so many novels put out each week. I'm astonished. I go into a bookshop and I go, I love it because it's like I love reading and I love stories, and I probably read 3 novels a week. But, you just go, how can people – there's so many novels put out every week. How do people choose? And so I guess it just helps, in the choosing. And it also – I think it does help your publishers feel more confident,
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time today. I've enjoyed our chat.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2025 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. And it's festival year, History Unbound, to be held at Parramatta Town Hall on the 1st and 2nd of November 2025. Both in-person and online tickets are available. Please visit our website www.hnsa.org.au, register for our newsletter, and join our social media groups to be up to date. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening, and keep imagining the past. Imagining the Past is commercial free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation, and we can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website, www.hnsa.org.au. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated.